Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host...
Christy.
In the Ustream track, Gonzo, 1332, are we waiting on Mackie's caffeine?
How do they know? Tell them no.
So, welcome to episode 165. I'm Makalua, who still really needs more caffeine, and of course, joining me as always, Dan Q.
BBK or BBR, brave behind keyboard or brave before reality?
Uh-huh. And me and team.
Greetings to all the listeners.
Imagine.
Yeah. So.
And our guest this week, Christy.
I need a Guinness.
The rumor mill spinning regarding One World. No, that's not the 24th season of Survivor, which is about 23 seasons too many at that point. It's rather about the rumor about a Civilization V One World expansion. I'm going to talk about the 2K thread. I know the CFC thread was started first, but the person who started it created an account, I guess, just for it, called Civilization V Rocks, and still just has this one post as of this recording. For people who do not know, a new expansion will be called One World. This is known from the website, and it's a Russian address. Any thoughts on this? If you go to that site, by the way, it lists apparently the Steam app IDs for Expansion One World Content and Expansion One World EXE, but if you click on one of the other, you get error. No app was found matching this app ID, which is funny.
It also got scrubbed after a bit. That only helped the speculation.
It started with that and quickly spread to a number of much larger, greater traffic websites on interwebs, like, NeoGAF, Reddit, and apparently GameSpy. GameSpy's Brian Mardini is claiming that he broke the story in the main news stream. He wrote a little blurb about it, published on the 15th of January. Quote, while trawling the depths of Steam's file registry, some enterprising Civ fans found a list that contains a couple of mysterious entries at the bottom. We already talked about that. On the official 2K Games and Civ Fanatics forums, speculation is already taking it as a given that this is a done deal, quote unquote. And then on the 2K forums, where his username is apparently Steph No Run, he said, we got the standard, we don't respond to rumors answer from 2K. They aren't denying it. They're just going to respond on their own terms. If you ran a business, you wouldn't alter all of your marketing plans just because people know some slivers of information ahead of time. And then, of course, why not open it for rampant speculation? Because, you know, that's all we can possibly do at this point. Actually, Hawk, who was a past guest on this show, has a conspiracy theory that this was on purpose, that this was deliberate to see how much extra attention they could potentially get, and thus more sales. So,
yeah.
It was an interest check, really? Come on.
You know what
would
be amusing is if this turned out to be a prank or something.
It's a little early for April Fools, isn't it?
Yeah,
but this was, like, I don't think it is, but that would be
it could be a reverse April Fool's Day joke. On April Fool's Day, they tell you the truth.
Oh, they'll put up the actual site and everything for the expansion on April 1st, and nobody will believe it.
Yeah.
It could happen.
You're going to actually be able to execute that Uncle Slam attack now.
Yeah. though I gotta say, it wasn't Steph. I know who Steph is. He thinks he broke it, but he really didn't. Puaki was the one who brought it over to 2K forums after it sat there on the CFC forums for quite some time, being probably a couple minutes anyways.
In the mainstream, quote-unquote mainstream news media, GameSpy, the person who wrote it for GameSpy is claiming that he broke it outside of the Civ forum.
Yeah, well, too bad.
Too bad what?
Whatever.
Oh, yeah, well,
that doesn't matter.
News.
We already knew about it. So really breaking it to who?
The rest of the internet that doesn't go on Civ Fanatics?
To break it to my sister.
Now, Gold Badger on the 2K forum thread said, I still would like some basic stuff fixed before embarking upon new ideas. That said, one world does kind of excite me with its possibilities. And that's the thing. This just became another reason to reiterate what people would like to see in the expansion. There are already threads for that. Can you keep that out of these threads? Please, K, thanks.
Well, except for the stuff that might have speculation related to the title. I mean, if it's related to the title and you can say, okay, this is what the title says, what do you think it means, which is where a lot of people went with the speculation. But yeah, there's some people who are like, well, we have to have this, this, and this. Like, how does that relate to the potential title? It doesn't, but that's what we need.
Tangentially relate any suggestion, as ridiculous or not, to the title. It's a little...
Yeah.
Permanent alliances. Go, go, go.
Oh, why not? God. Why not?
Well, yes, permanent alliances, because if you're permanently aligned, then you're all part of one world.
All one
yeah.
world.
See? Yeah. Yeah.
It's part of a diplomacy, which is like one of the things people have been saying a lot, that there must be diplomacy changes. Yeah. So therefore, alliances, permanent alliances, it all ties in.
But we got to have corporations because, you know, corporations run the world. Oh, wait, one world.
Oh, no. Look, no. Sid Sushi. We need Sid Sushi back. Brilliant. I love Sid Sushi.
Although I got to point out that the people say, like, for Gold Badger and that, you want some basic stuff fixed. Gods and Kings, as much as it had new content, fixed a crazy amount of crap that was in vanilla and had nothing to do with the specific direction of that, you know, the name of the expansion or whatever. So while there was, you know, religion and spies added, there was, you know, a brand new combat system, a different tech tree, a crazy number of bugs fixed. Was fixed both for vanilla and for Gods and Kings. So if you want to use that as the basis, then I'm sure there will be things fixed in this one.
Too.
On the CFC news thread, MacAttack says, what? Another expansion, but Civ 5 Gods and Kings is perfect. Wait. Kilo on the 2K thread says, by the way, how accurate is this information? That Steam database leak couldn't be a hoax. That's said as a question. Couldn't someone have inserted some fake info for the fans to catch the bait? Just asking because I think it's too good to be true. And then the Stethno Run says, whenever you think something is a conspiracy, it's much more likely that someone just screwed up. Hypercompetence is much less common than incompetence.
Yep. Did they do it on purpose or did Valve screw up?
Well, let's see.
If it's those two choices, did 2K actually do something marketing-wise that makes sense and could be cool and different, or did Steam screw up?
Steam screwed up.
I was actually trying to check one of the other reliable sites of this the Steam app list, and I'm not seeing anything about it. So unless they're covered behind one of those Valve test app titles.
Even if there was a Valve test app title, it wouldn't matter because this has nothing to do with that. This is more about...
In the past, Valve test apps have... They basically put Valve test app in the CDR until it's going to release and they change the name. Like, I have a couple of Valve test apps on my thing because I'm doing some beta for a few things, so...
Yeah. No, it's not that. It's somebody actually scraped the data from the... it's more from the store side than from the other side that they took the data from. So it has nothing to do with the test apps or anything along that line. This was like somewhere in there. And they've since cleaned it up, which means that it was in the list and then it's been deleted from the list.
Would explain why the linked app ID isn't showing up anywhere in this list either that I can see. Well,
exactly. Apparently, Paradox has had this problem with Steam for a very, very long time, to the point where they've just randomized names for everything and then added extras so that people wouldn't know. Apparently, according to people on the interweb, because everything you hear on the interweb is true.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To AC Kurz over on YouTube, who asked in response to our video from the last episode over at YouTube where you can get the captions, wanted to know if we were going to talk about One World on the next show. And my response was, yes, that rumor. The answer to your question is to be revealed tomorrow during the live recording of episode 165, because this is from yesterday. So there's your answer.
Did you also tell me you could find it at thepolycast.net?
No, but you just did, Mackie.
Good job.
Thank you.
There you go. Yeah, and for all those people who watch Beyond the Monument and have been asking for a week, and for all those people who watch my daily streams and been asking for a week, seriously, stop asking. Can't stop asking because we finally talked about it. from Canis Albinus in the live chat. Is there a precedent for releasing the second expansion pack the year after the first? I would say, what, Warlords and Beyond the Sword were about that distance away?
Yeah, that's correct. 2006 and 2007, respectively.
So, yes, there is a precedent. When you can't get on a boat because you're landlocked, Chrome's 99 put up this thread called Landlocked States. What he actually meant is landlocked civilizations, not necessarily a state. So the question is, shouldn't there be barriers to trade for landlocked states who do not have a direct connection to friendly trading partners? I'm going to Uganda in June and thought how the country is landlocked and how it depends on its friendly neighbors to get its exports to port. As we all know, trade routes to partners outside of the empire were important for all civilizations through history, though some empires kept most trade within their empire for their own reason. Maybe these ideas should be used in Civ 5. Thoughts? One thought is, in Civ 5, if you do not have open borders, you can't go anywhere. So, yes, you are somewhat dependent on your neighbors to be able to go elsewhere if you are completely surrounded.
Yeah, there's a barrier, and there's also a barrier embedded in his opening post.
Yeah.
So if you are landlocked, you're having to rely on friendly neighbors to get to port, then if you don't have any naval cities, then actually trying to get out into the world by sea...
it is pretty much dead. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're not on a purely land-based map, being completely landlocked is a bad idea, just in general. Basically, his whole intent, I think, is more about international trade routes and other such things. Because obviously, internal trade routes between your own cities, doesn't matter if you're landlocked or not, you just build a road and you're good to go. So in this particular case, he's more talking about, you know, trade, unless he means that you shouldn't be able to trade with somebody, i.e. luxury for gold or other such things, without having open borders to your neighbors, i.e. there has to be some sort of connection between the two, in which case, ow, ugly. Or he's talking about wanting international trade routes. But then if you're still landlocked, you still need your neighbors, because I'm pretty sure you, even if you do international trade routes, you still want to go through their territory without them killing you for it. In Civ 5, that's open borders. So basically, yes, you are kind of landlocked. Empire is bad for trading with other people.
All right, well, this thread is started by Hirlo, Keeper of the Truth, apparently. I am also a Keeper of the Truth, as in, I will not give it to you. Anyway, it's titled, Why Was Pakal Afraid of Me? So I've been playing Gods and Kings game on a huge Earth map as America, or why I started in East Africa. Sensible. Pakal is to the north and a pretty good ways off. I think he'd been guarded with me for a while and coveted my lands. But one day he comes up and offers a declaration of friendship with me, and his status is afraid. I accepted the doff. But when I went and looked at what my military advisor had to say, and he says that the Maya are more powerful than me. I also checked the info addict, and it shows me on the bottom in the military list. And Pakal's a good ways above me. Does anyone know what triggers this? It seems strange that he was afraid and seemingly is more powerful than me.
Matthew, period, and I'm not just saying that for emphasis, there actually is a period at the end of the username, says, military strength. The game seems to take into account multiple civs if war is involved, which is why it is easier to get peace deals when there are multiple civs at war.
Generally. He's probably not afraid of you. He's probably afraid about somebody else and just doesn't want you getting involved.
Please don't dogpile me.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Civ AI has used that for a long time. I know it used it in Civ 4, and I think it used it before that as well. Like, it actually does factor powers of enemies that are at, like, of civs that the current civ is at war with when making decisions. And that also raises its dogpile odds in Civ 4, and it would not surprise me if that also raised its dogpile odds in Civ 5, because it makes sense.
Mm. It's in most multi-agent games, strategy games.
Yeah. You
know? That guy's getting weak. Hey, you know what we should do? Go take his cities before the other guy does.
Yep. Pakal is being sensible here, because like 6 or 7 units, well, it's not a lot, can still take your cities, and if you don't have any forces because you're fighting somebody else, well...
Steamroll!
Yeah?
Don't feel like getting stabbed in the back while you're fighting in the front.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's not just about how well do you use the military force that you have in the size, but it's also where it's positioned and how quickly it can get back to deal with something that wasn't expected, or maybe should have been expected. Now, Smallfish, who was a guest on episode 163, linked to the leader attribute spreadsheet, which we first talked about last September in episode 157. And under sieve biases, afraid is one of seven variables. And what I find is hilarious is that Montezuma is actually seven.
He's more likely to be afraid?
Yes.
I actually did get a screenshot of where Monty was afraid of me. And I was like, really? Like, yep. You, well, Monty, afraid. Enough. How does this happen?
From 2 to 7, and seven. So 7 is the maximum. He's with Shizhong and Maria Theresa at 7. I was like, what?
He's afraid of you. You know, like he saw that you are powerful potential, and he got scared. And so, in self-defense, he amassed an army and declared upon you.
Yes.
So you never know. You could be getting him cranked up to be slightly more chance to be afraid. It's one of those games. I think the original synopsis was more correct. If Pakel's very likely to be attacked or is currently in a war by somebody else who's much bigger than him, yeah, he very possibly will turn around and go, hey, buddy, want to be my friend?
Want to be my friends? I don't feel that really pointy dagger in my back.
Yeah, actually, you see it with AIs that are at war and are getting trashed constantly, fairly often. They'll just randomly reach out to you and go, like, I know I didn't like you. They might not go all the way to afraid, but they're like, yeah, I know I didn't like you, but hey, want to be friends? Because everybody else is killing me.
That status is probably not going to last very long. Anyway, Pilgrim must have been reading my mind, because Pilgrim says, you know, it happened to me on Deity, and then he declared war on me a couple of turns later. And a few turns later, all of a sudden, they are not afraid of you. And then maybe a few turns later, they are afraid of you again. And it's more common in the earlier game as well.
Well, it could be that they're afraid of you, and then if you turn them down for that friendship, they could factor that in and go, oh, yeah, you know what? You are weak. Maybe I'll just kill you first.
I've seen this bipolar thing myself. I think I forget who it was, but he came up to me and asked me, you know, we're good friends, so I want you to denounce this person because of it. I said no, and he immediately denounced me instead.
Yeah, because you refused to denounce his enemy. Therefore, you're the friend of his enemy.
But I may not be the friend of his enemy. I'm maybe the enemy of his enemy, but
You refused to denounce? Therefore, you like the other enemy more than you like him. Therefore, he doesn't like you anymore.
I would say anecdotally, the civ that's done that most to me, saying that they're afraid and, you know, that I'm paragon of leadership. I also love that use of the word paragon in this context. Would be Darius, who's actually 6 on the list. 6 out of 10.
He probably has a subroutine so that when he's during a golden age, it's 2. Arcade8583 said, so I got an upgrade for my opening warrior, and I decided to try an idea I had. Hit and run a city-state for XP. Hard going, but worth it. Then I found cover 1 and 2, and found that the city-state only did 10 damage. And he's claiming it's an exploit.
Taking proper upgrades is totally an exploit, guys.
Yeah, this has been in the game since the beginning. You can sit there and get shot constantly and get experience constantly. So what are you doing with that unit?
I'm just sitting here, setting up a camp, you know, getting ready to, you know, taking in the scenery. No, don't mind me, don't mind me. We'll just, you know.
Oh, here comes a new volley. Block, 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 block.
New arrows. No big deal.
Some people have complained that it must be an exploit because the AI doesn't really do it.
No.
Best logic ever. We all need to play like the AI.
It's exploitive because the AI doesn't think it's a good idea to sit there and just soak it in. Meanwhile, I would like to point out, people used to complain, and still do, that the AI units will sit there and fortify heal when they get shot and not move away. All you're doing when you sit there and get shot by a city-state is fortify heal and not move away. So people complain that the AI used to do that. They just didn't know it was XP farming you, except badly because it kept dying. It did technically used to sit there and constantly get shot.
Get your archer like logistics and +1 range and firing over cover and everything. It'd take forever though.
Yeah.
Zizimus says, yeah, this isn't so much an exploit as it is a painfully obvious tactic. Think you guys are confusing exploit with imbalance.
exploit with I have too much time on my hands to micromanage this guy and get his XP up.
Did you not need that unit? For anything else? Okay.
Apparently not.
No.
Have you declared this particular city-state your cover training camp?
Well, if it's a hostile city-state, yeah, why not?
Yeah, well, you're allowed one DAO versus a city-state before people get mad, unless, of course, people are protecting them.
However, that early in the game with his opening warrior and somehow turn 111, still, early enough, people probably aren't protecting city-states that are very near capitals.
Keeping in mind, this is turn 111 in a marathon game.
Yeah. Because 2390 BC. Yeah, this is gonna, you know, we're just gonna be here a while. He'll be to march by, you know, 1500 BC.
He might actually get some decent experience then because of the just sheer number of turns he can park there before anything else happens.
Yeah.
That brings up later on in the thread where people are saying that XP is more valuable the slower the game is, and is the levels don't change.
Yep.
I think the value of an individual experience is lessened on Marathon, but you're more likely to be able to capitalize on it, is the more fair way.
Well, if you keep the unit alive, it's around longer, and therefore you have more turns to actually get experience on that.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Yeah, yeah.
To interject from the line that this is, in fact, an exploit, I want to ensure that we get all sides in on here to the extent. Fury Crab says, the line between you exploiting the AI tactics and you just holding your ground to a dumb enemy unit is a bit of a blur. However, it's mostly about setup and intention. No one can stop you from doing it, but I personally never find it fun to win by pulling off AI exploits.
Yeah, kind of like selling all your stuff to the AI before you DAO.
He also mentions that in his post, as a matter of fact, Dan.
That doesn't happen in our games at all.
That is not an exploit.
Yeah,
that's just a painfully obvious tactic.
Yeah, it is a painfully obvious tactic. Working as intended.
Dan. It can happen in real life, just annoy a lot of people if it ever did, but, you know.
For this one, it'd be so hard to actually come up with a game rule to prevent exploit-ish type behavior without turning around and going, by the way, this is stupid game behavior. Like, seriously, do you have nothing better to do with that unit? Why did you build it if you didn't?
That said, they could potentially do something like diminishing returns on the gaining XP when defending.
Except that now you have diminishing returns when you're fighting a war and so your units aren't getting...
They'd have to apply to everything, not just being in the city-state.
Because they'd have to stop, because maybe you are fighting a war versus that city-state, and your best action for that particular unit is to fortify heal, so that other units can catch up. Do you get diminishing returns based on being smart?
Maybe.
And not purposely doing it. And like Dan already said, it's about the intent. No developer is going to have a mechanic in there that is perfectly fine normally, because you're not intending to do something, and then they randomly flip a switch going, yeah, at about this point we decided that you're intending to do this, so we'll just change that.
Okay, or maybe another alternative would be, instead of just gaining a flat amount of XP when you're defending, you will gain XP based on how much damage you inflict. And that could be a global change.
Yeah, but that's forward damage, and then when you get double medic, type units that can constantly shoot things and get shot but heal all the damage, then they can stand there next to the city shooting the city state and constantly heal it all. Same thing.
I suppose.
I think that's better.
That's more.
No, I don't like getting experience based on damage done, because that will snowball a tech lead even more than currently.
Yeah. Like, hey, I can do more damage because I've got more promotion.
It's not something that can be solved in 2 seconds.
There's no problem in the first place. There's a clear trade-off when you're grinding for XP this way. You're not using that unit for anything else.
What if you weren't already using them? What if they were your static defense in the case of someone coming to you and being like, I'm just going to randomly declare war on you. Right, I have 20 units sitting here. Good luck.
Okay, so you're paying, what, 40 gold per turn up front, and then it goes up to 60, then 80, then 100?
Yeah.
You just wasted a crazy amount of gold that you could have spent on something else.
If it stops them coming to me every 2 turns saying, your military is useless, then yeah, well, I'll pay that.
Sure. You show up, I kill 10 of your units for every one of my units that you kill. Yeah, that's good odds.
I just don't see the exploit here. Usually exploits are references to tactics that are significantly better than all of their alternatives. Or that they're really strong things that have a great impact on the outcome of the game. That's why you're exploiting the game. But this...
Yeah, but
I mean, in a marathon game, I guess since you're multiplying the number of turns by three, if you bring a bunch of spearmen out to stand around a city-state and you get them up to, say, level four, five, six promotions after, I don't know, 90 turns worth of doing that, then you upgrade them to pikes and then upgrade them to lancers, and then you might have some super heavy power lancers. It is exploitive-ish in that line of reasoning, intent-wise anyways, to do that, but it's not an effective one. And I think that's the problem. That's why you don't see high-level players doing it constantly. If it was, then they would be doing it constantly. And even in the thread, I mean, Tabernacle's like the first poster. It says, like, no value, basically.
Pilgrim in the chat says, it's very effective with ships since they're so slow on experience gaining.
Not really. I've taken down 40 combat strength cities with a handful of galleuses. They'll get their experience as they're taking out stuff. And then once they get ranged, they get lots of experience because they never have to worry about getting hit again.
Getting to range is the point in some case, depending on the strength of the city you're attacking.
Ah, that's where you go left side of honor, get that plus 50%.
Mm. Then it's 3 XP every time.
It's significantly faster.
The pilgrim responds to you, imagine, by saying, eventually.
Yeah, but if you don't take honor, then yes, it takes a very, very long time, and still no grinding required to really get it up. I mean, sure, you grind on lower combat strength cities taking first, and then you go to higher combat strength ones, but you don't just need to sit there and grind them. Although you can a little bit, but as long as you're attacking somebody to do damage and cause trouble, then you're using it. And then you're grinding effectively. If you're just sitting there with a city state that's not going to do anything other than sit there, then you're not grinding effectively.
Like if you're using a meat shield, that's effective grinding.
That too.
Meat shield for a reason.
Combat engineers, kind of, sort of. Dr. Z posted this over on Civ Fanatics about using workers as frontline engineers during the war. He says, after the last patch, every unit of the pillages will heal 25 hit points, but counting that with a worker repairing the improvement, the unit can pillage twice each turn for a total of 50 hit points a turn. Weren't we just talking about exploits, guys? This works better if you choose Liberty or have the pyramids, otherwise repairing will not take place the same turn. He was rarely using workers with his frontline force, but after seeing this, now he uses them all the time while attacking his engineers. So he also does things like build roads and remove forest, you know, to get there faster. He wanted to know if everybody else is doing stuff like this.
I love how they get a new name, too. They're workers when they're back home, but when they go into somebody else's territory, we start calling them engineers.
Combat engineers, man.
It reminds me of Age of Empires 2, where you could buy the sapper's upgrade. And basically, your workers would do insane levels of damage to enemy buildings. That was fun.
Do I ever use workers on the front line? No, never. Hey, buddy, I think you're busy.
If the worker AI is going to place them on the front line anyway and in danger, you might as well use them for something useful.
Yep.
Dr. Z, who I hope it's Dr. Zayas, Dr. Zayas, says that, I tried this on standard speed, he appends here. I was thinking about workers I capture that do the repairing and other stuff. I don't really bring workers with my army unless I badly need a road to that location. Both Feiling and Dogmoth say that this is too powerful. Dogmoth saying, at quick, I would regard repairing tiles in enemy territory as very much an exploit. And Feiling is saying, it's pretty imba, only on quick game speed, though.
Yeah, well, it's the Liberty, like, worker speed bonus plus the pyramids, plus quick speed. Yes, you get it down to one turn to repair. And therefore, yes, you can, on quick speed games, mass pillage and repillage and basically never get killed if they're not doing enough damage.
Worker equals super medic.
Yeah, basically.
Pretty much.
So I would agree on that part. Being able to repair enemy tiles with workers should not be happening.
I was going to say, that's the weird part, because we couldn't build things in enemy territory, but why would we be repairing it? That doesn't make any sense.
Sorry, burn down your, you know.
I burned down this farming village. Oh, wait, I rebuilt it, guys.
Sorry, it's okay. We're all good now, right?
Right, till the next turn rolls over. Oops, I burnt it again.
But it's repaired again.
Yeah.
I am pro being able to build roads in enemy territory, because that's always good. Although, if you're just sitting there building roads to spam roads to force the cost to go up, that's pretty bad. But if you're building a road to a new city, then that's okay. Removing forests, removing marshes, yep, should be able to do both of those.
I just have to say, spamming roads into enemy territory simply to raise their cost, I consider that along the lines of camping your unit there doing nothing, trying to get experience, only worse. Who would do that?
Well, if you only took one turn to build a road...
Oh, yeah, but, like, are you attacking to not take the city? I don't understand. And then when you take the city, what are you going to do? You're going to have to get rid of that.
Well, keep in mind, you can also get open border agreement with somebody that you're not at war with.
Oh, okay. That's acceptable. I was thinking along the lines of war engineers, as they're being called here, though.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this Uber speed thing is kind of a specific situation, right? I mean, you need to be on quick speed. You know, you're down Liberty, but you also have the pyramids, because either you built it for yourself or you captured it. I agree, in that situation, maybe something needs to be done, but it's not like you're going to be able to replicate this repeatedly game after game after game.
Yeah, no. But yeah, it's the pillage thing, and it didn't used to be a problem because, yeah, you can pillage farms and stuff, and you get a little bit of gold, but it was never enough gold, even when you pillage twice, to really be that worthwhile. Because you have to keep in mind that the workers cost you gold per turn, and so do the units. So to stay there doing nothing other than sitting there and pillaging, fixing and pillaging and fixing, that costs a lot gold per turn wise. So you're making very little out of it. You will make some, but it wasn't enough to really want to do it. But it's the 25 hit points healing per pillage, and therefore bumping it up to 50 that really turns the ability to repair in enemy territory a problem.
A little earlier in the chat, Monthar and Ecat 2468. Monthar asks, past guest on Polycast 2, would it be an exploit if the AI did it as well? And Ecat's like, it wouldn't. It would be a mechanic. And Monthar says, exactly.
It's only because there's a human AI behind it. Wait.
Yeah.
Make Deep Blue play. Be grand.
Pilgrim, who was in the chat, also actually responded in this thread and talked about on the MP front, I can't see anything wrong with repillaging improvements in multiplayer since human players, unlike the AI, can and will use the same tactics you use, thus it's all fair and square. While I don't think they would necessarily use the same tactics you use, they may not realize that it's to their advantage, and sometimes just because a human player does something in a game doesn't mean that you should too, but I get where you're coming at, because now we're separating ourselves from the AI consideration and just like human player versus human player.
Yeah, should you be able to improve, repillage, and improve in a multiplayer game? I'd still say no. It just does not work well to allow that. But yes, is it fair? Yes, others can do it, though if you're fighting the war in their territory, they're not exactly able to do it back to you because you're in their territory, and therefore you have more advantage than they do. Although if they, you know, want to send a few units off to your city to do the same at the same time, even though they're probably going to be losing their own city, whatever. So even in multiplayer, there is an imbalance on that because you're only fight in one person's territory at that point. So one person will have the advantage in a war and the other one will not.
Great.
Speaking of advantages... I don't know.
Tearing down the Great Wall, right?
Yes, indeed.
Dan would like to see that a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people would like to see that.
Dan's favorite AI-based wonder.
In Civ 5 and Civ 4, nobody really gives a crap.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about Civ 5 on this one.
I'm exaggerating a bit. I mean, with Civ 4, if you got barbs, okay, yeah, but it was
bad.
If someone else builds it or I don't get it, it's not against quote unquote an AI proper. And Civ 5, it's just
it's a troll face wonder. Civ 5, it's a troll face wonder. Like, oh, you're coming to attack me? Eh, maybe not.
This is why someone else needs to introduce this topic, because it'd just be a mass editorialization.
Yeah, so other than Dan's sheer and utter hatred for this thing, and his sheer refusal, even though he completely and utterly hates this thing, to build it himself first.
That is not an appropriate response.
It is!
Yes, it is!
It is the most appropriate response to deal with.
Denied.
The only way to stop them from building it is to build it yourself.
Exactly.
It shouldn't be that, okay, let me say what it is that I'm trying to say. It shouldn't be that, okay, Dan, well, given the nature of this, I guess you better build it yourself before somebody else. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying that shouldn't just be the automatic response, and therefore it's not an issue, that we shouldn't address the issue otherwise. That's what gets me annoyed.
So, and it's just the fact that it always happens to Dan exactly when he goes to attack a civ, and whatever civ he chooses to attack is the one who happens to build the Great Wall a couple turns later. I think that's like part Murphy's of Dan's law, hatred. Dan declares war. Great Wall goes up. What?
It's like they saved a great engineer just to build that, just to annoy you.
Yeah, I think so. The game, Civ 5 likes to troll Dan. Anywho, the real question, because I'm pretty sure Syntax here knows nothing of Dan's problems. Or maybe he does, and that's why he made the threat.
We're starting a club.
Is it even possible to land, invade a nation with the Great Wall? Of course.
Yes.
So anyways, he says his armies of pikes and crossbows gets ravaged by composite bows. Well, that just means that if you have pikes and crossbows and you're getting ripped apart by composite bows, you're doing it wrong.
The Great Wall is powerful, but even I can't hate on the Great Wall that much.
Yeah, that's got to be really bad to get yourself killed off that way. The question comes down to, how do you get through the Great Wall if somebody puts it up? As I've said, and as we've discussed previously, but not as directly, great generals have this special ability called Slap Up a Citadel, and it'll take land. So the most direct route in is to obviously know which city actually built it, and then start slapping in citadels all the way up to the city. That way you convert it over to your territory and don't have the movement penalty, so you can just slide in, slide out, keep wandering around. Plus, it's a citadel, so if the AI tries to come into your territory, they will get damaged, and therefore you can keep pushing forward, and you just keep citadel bombing them. Keep in mind that you need your culture borders to be touching theirs. So either you have to take a city next to that particular city the hard way, or just slap up a settler if you really need to do it. But basically you need a culture border, and then you can move your great general one tile past your culture border, settle the citadel, get the tiles, and then you just keep doing that all the way in. That is the most effective way to crush it. Other ways is just go horses. Horse units can at least still move two. Same for berserkers, actually. Anything that can move three or more tiles will be able to continue wandering around. Not as fast as they normally do, but they can get there faster, which means that the AI and or player will have less time to reinforce. And especially if they have roads in the background, get horses in the back, pillage the roads. That'll at least stop them from being able to reinforce easily. That's how you break the Great Wall. You just walk right in there and slap up citadels all over the place, take their land, and then take their city.
ECAT in the chat says, another suggestion, obsolete by a player for discovering dynamite, not the player that built it to discover dynamite.
And that's a fairly common request, actually. Very common.
Sensible request, too.
Yeah, it's very sensible, but it hasn't happened yet. Carmel archers and keshiks are absolutely great for clearing not just the enemy units, but once you get through your range, the enemy city. But otherwise, don't wait till dynamite, because the one with the Great Wall will probably just use that as a base to continue expanding, and by the time you get in there, well, it might be too late.
Lord Olaus in the thread talks about the technological superiority works, and it is true. I have been able, as much as I still rage about it, if you have not just technological superiority and or the numbers that are positioned accordingly, because a civ could have a lot of units, and kind of tying into a previous thread, but they're all the way over there. Actually, in a co-op game I just had, I declared on the AI, and of course they built the Great Wall, like we've already established. But rather than bringing their units back as I invaded, and I did not use a citadel, I didn't have to, but part of that was because I had a city of theirs already that I'd captured before they built the Great Wall, so I'm already on their borders, and their culture borders only extended one hex from their city. So I was able to bombard it, and for some reason, the AI decided to keep attacking an allied city-state of mine off in the north instead of bringing their units down south. So the only attack that I was getting was a bombarding of the units by the city, and I did manage to trick them into attacking my scouts a couple of times instead of, you know, attacking a composite bow, for instance. But Lord Elias kind of extends on the technological superiority by saying, bringing superior numbers is of a limited advantage, as you won't be able to use your second line of troops. Thus, if numerical superiority doesn't constitute a big advantage and maneuvering is limited, all that is left is having better individual units. So that's either having well-promoted units, he says, which is difficult, or technologically superior units, which is easier. Although I guess that kind of depends. If you've already been having a lot of warfare and successful at this point, you may already have well-promoted units, and that's ready to go, as opposed to advancing your science to get technologically superior units. But point taken.
But actually, as Pilgrim said in the thread, and he's quite right on it, the Great Wall really only affects open terrain for units that aren't mounted, because if you're walking into rough terrain, it doesn't matter if there's a Great Wall. Your two-move unit will only move one. So for the great majority of units, based on rough terrain, the Great Wall really doesn't do anything. So if you're used to fighting in rough terrain, trying to advance and take territory and everything like that, you're fine, because you'll have been doing it anyway. So it doesn't really matter if the Great Wall exists. It's only in open terrain. The pain on that is, of course, that open terrain also gives you a negative towards your unit defense just for standing there versus rough terrain, which gives you a bonus. So when in doubt, go through the rough terrain. And you can do it, too. I mean, pikes and crossbows should easily be able to take down a city that only has composite bows, because you just advance in a line. Don't get too close to the city while you're advancing your units, killing off their units, and just slowly take a step forward. You're just not going to be able to get that speed boost through open terrain to get a perfect surround on a city or something along that line. Take your time, be effective, be efficient, and just go.
And in the chat, Monthar says, unless it's a unit that doesn't have the rough terrain movement penalty, such as the Minutemen, or Incan units with hills.
Yeah, yeah, special case. Talk special case, go by water. They build a Great Wall, go through the water. Great Wall does not affect ocean.
Yes, but of course, inevitably, when the AI does it to me, it's in a city that is landlocked. Reference to a previous thread, look at that. And, of course, it's built in a city that has lots of open terrain.
Although a slight addendum to the rough terrain point, if it is a mounted unit, it does get slowed down a little bit, or if it's three movement, because it does add a movement point cost to rough terrain anyways. So if it's a faster moving unit, it might not be as fast in rough terrain.
Yes, and all of this said, I'll just say, because we're actually tackling this this topic directly for the first time. I know there's other ways to modify the Great Wall, but for me myself, if you want to limit the movement in the city that has the Great Wall, I've got no problem with that. But, of course, it's often, and smartly so, that it's probably in a city that you can't get to right away because it's deeper in the Civ's Empire, because it has, you know, better production, so they're more likely to be able to build it before somebody else builds it. But it's those other cities that don't have the Great Wall that gives them that benefit that really starts to cheese me off. Like, I'd have no problem saying, like, it gives them instant walls or better walls, but if you were to change that, that would take a lot of my rage away. But if you like my rage, then I guess, you know, you can just leave it the way it is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Mongols had the same rage. Stupid Chinese, why you build a wall out here? Build it around your city.
Seriously. Of course, jump over this wall.
That said, it could be another change to do is in the sense that the Great Wall only affects them going into your territory, like removing all movement or adding some other penalty. But when, once you get past the wall, it's like, I'm grand, I just run around like crazy.
I mean, that would be okay, but then you should be able to fortify on the wall on your external borders and get a boost, etc., etc.
This thread is started by Calandra in the Civ 4 general discussions and titled The Logic Behind Resource Bonuses. Basically, Calandra is wondering why rice has the most pathetic bonus among the food resources. Euro-American centricness? My answer, yes. It feeds billions, literally, of the population in Asia. But in game-wise, you can't farm rice unless it's near a water source, unlike cows, sheep, horses. That's actually wrong. You can farm rice, always, as long as you have agriculture. But its yield is awful, and there's no reason for that whatsoever. If you're going to compare it to leader corn, it should probably have more yield, not less. So I don't know what to say other than that illogical resource bonuses in Civ 4 are far from unique to rice, at least. So
Civ 5?
Civ 4. This Civ 5 is a Civ 4 thread.
I know, but even in Civ 5.
Oh, okay.
The bonuses are sometimes a little weird.
That's true. Well, I think that's also traditional to Civ games, though, as neither Civ 4 or Civ 5 pioneered this concept.
Yeah, no.
Of giving asinine yield values. And if you go down throughout the thread, people are pointing out that, like, say, oil has way too low of a yield, that a standard tile improvement that is not terrain-specific actually has higher yields. And, like, why is silver only spawning in tundra-type areas? Why can't stone and marble be on grassland? It has to be on plains. Tacky Waxon also mentions industrialism obsoleting fur for some reason, which, yeah, that doesn't really make sense. I don't know. I don't know what logic goes behind some of these more minor decisions, but I can certainly agree that rice should be equal yields to the others. And honestly, I didn't see a reason to single it out because it just raises the chance of getting an awful capital starting position. So it does kind of annoy me that rice is weaker.
As has been raised in the thread for Civ 5 specifically, we can single out bananas.
Oh, but as Kidar pointed out further down in the thread, is rice really pathetic? It's just one food less than other grains and is buffed by being a key ingredient in sushi.
However, that requires something on the sword. Some people are relying on Civ 4 vanilla.
Well, that's their own fault.
That's their
fault. Oh, we're being elitist now, are we?
You mean it was like 5 cents the other day to get the expansions?
The problem with the whole sushi thing is that most games' outcomes, win or loss, are decided long before you can actually build Sid-Sushi. Now, you can use Sid-Sushi to cover a position to some degree, but usually people are using it to milk their score and get tons and tons of population so they get a higher score. It's rarely something that makes a decisive outcome on the game. Usually your decisions before sushi, before the Renaissance, are what's changing whether or not you're going to win or lose, for the most part. So when you start with a capital that has one floodplain only and a rice that is not irrigated, you have basically no food at all. And that's a really harsh start when someone else gets like two riverside corns or something.
Yeah,
they're getting eight bonus food over the tiles worked, and you're getting two. They basically have four times the yield per pop working tile that you do at pop two, and that's just going to stay true the entire game on those cities.
Yeah, but that's exactly the same in Civ 5 as well. Somebody gets a start where they get wheat on a river versus not getting wheat at all, or deer, or whatever, and then you slap up a granary. Well, now you're getting more food all game long. Why? Because your start had this. No real difference.
My point is the variance between those two starts in Civ 4 is so great that it gets to the point where it's ridiculous.
It's the same in Civ 5.
I guess. It's not a good mechanic in either game.
Two wheat on a river versus no wheat, and even if you have the same river, yeah, it's a huge difference.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. I think Civ 5 is a little bit less harsh with spawn variants than Civ 4, but it's still a big problem, and I don't know why they can't unify like total food or do something to make the spawns at least a little bit more reasonable compared against each other.
Flavor. You don't want strategic balance constantly.
You don't have to strategically balance everything, but give people a reasonable baseline capital. At least make the minimum capital decent.
Well, in theory, there is the script.
It
balances things out. The problem is, what is it balancing? You do have to keep in mind that the starting script also keeps in mind late game resources. So if you happen to have all of the uranium or all of the aluminum or all of the coal, or at least a lot of it, then you're not going to know about that till late game. But somebody who gets a lot of extra food doesn't necessarily get the late game strategic resources, which
you'd have to wait those much less, though. You'd have to.
Coal is massive, plus 50%.
Yeah, but you have to get there first. You have to survive till you get to coal, and you have to somehow get a decent position by the time you get there.
Expand, just like everybody else.
Okay, but you're expanding at a weaker rate. So the bonus value of having coal unless you're like the monopoly owner of it or whatever. It's like anything else in any Civ game ever. You know, the advantages early are more relevant on a consistent basis.
Generally, but it just depends. Sometimes you have better luxuries.
Yeah, trade those away and get lots of gold.
That's, and then just buy stuff.
Buy more food buildings.
Or you can get basically nothing. And there too, I haven't played as much Civ 5 as you guys, but I've never really seen an equivalent start in Civ 5, and this is to the credit of Civ 5, that just completely hoses you like some of the Civ 4 starts do. Like where you just get a Plains Cow and a Floodplain, or you just get a Dry Rice and a Floodplain. It's so little food, it hampers your expansion rate so much in Civ 4 that it's pretty crippling, especially if you also don't have a lot of commerce.
Yeah, I've seen that too. We've had, you know, lots of food but no production, or lots of production but no food.
But you have lots of something. That's my point. There's no lots of production in Civ 4. The reliance on the food as a tile yield is so great that if you only have like a Floodplain and a Dry Rice, you're not going to be able to get any production either. You can't whip. You can't really use those to work a lot of mines. You're just behind. Well, you're behind dozens of turns from turn zero. It's difficult to work with that.
No, that's the same thing for Civ 5. If you have lots of production but no real food, then you're never going to grow or not grow fast enough to actually use that production.
You can compensate that with food buildings and what have you, at least to some degree, and social policies. And
it's not enough, really, because, you have to get there.
I'm just saying the start variance is less drastic. At least it seems so to me.
Yeah, I've seen a good 30, 40 turn variance to hit philosophy.
I think it's more a case of the variance in starting layouts, at least in Civ 5, while you may lose food, you'll gain an equivalent amount of gold or production. So you kind of, if you add everything together, you always have a kind of a certain number. Whereas, you know, as you say, in Civ 4, if you have the Dry Rice, you don't have anything, you have like one Floodplain, you're basically going to end up with a lot less overall at the beginning.
Yeah, it's basically starting with nothing.
No, I mean,
that's like it's starting with a 20% penalty to all your hits.
Yeah.
But that's why we have Civ 5.
But up, up, up. Elitist.
This game changed my life. That's true for me. Okay, but this is also someone else has said this. It's not just me. Started by LPMC723, capital on the L. I was in the store one day and saw this game on the shelf, and yes, this game being Civilization V, at least I assume, seeing as how it was in a Civ 5 forum. $50 being the price, I was a little unsettled to say the least. I decided against it and went home, but the game never left my mind, so I looked online at some videos and read some reviews, all of which made this game look amazing. So after a few days of debate, I figured this game was more than worth the price attached to it, so I went back to the store and picked it up. Now let me explain how this changed my life. After a few weeks of playing this game, I got so fascinated with ancient and past civilizations that I began to read up on them, and I studied a lot of world history and read as much as I could because I became so curious and fascinated with things. All of this led me to think about my life and what I was doing. I was 29 years old with a job that paid next to nothing, and I couldn't make ends meet on some months. So I decided that if I'm studying all of this on my own for no reason, why not do it for real? So I enrolled in college to make something of my life. I'm now a few months short away from having my associate's degree in business, and after which I will have a great, decent-paying job lined up that will see me set up to continue for my bachelor's degree. And I assure you, all of this is because the game sparked an interest in me to study history and got me thinking. And my favorite response in the thread was from Kamikaze, who was a guest on episode 83 of Polycast back in 2009, where he says, "It changed my life too. I used to be a productive member of society." For a productive member of society.
We could all say that. It changed our lives. Look up Steam. 700 hours of Civ 5. Oh, God.
Just 700? Seriously?
I think I'm only 700. Hey, No. All my errors are in Team Fortress 2, you know.
Well, well, 700, you are a lightweight, sir, lightweight.
You have not had your life changed. You may go back home.
Just because I don't have that many errors. Like I said, I may only have, if this thing will ever load, it's like 500, 600, 700. I've got 1,500 in TF2. There is my life.
Oh, so you've wasted 1,500 hours in TF2?
Yes, another 600 on top of that in Civ 5.
But hey, guys, look at it this way. At least there's no counter to tell us how much time we've wasted in Minecraft.
Yep.
no, Raptor tracks Minecraft for me.
Oh, dear.
Well, I would say we should give Chris some slack here. What about previous Civ titles? Give those at, you know...
discounted rate.
No. All my Civ 4 hours are tracked by Steam as well. I'm a late bloomer to the Civ.
Yeah, see, if you take your TF2 and then you add it to your Civ, and then even if you add your Civ 4 time, that still doesn't add up to my official Civ 5 time. And that's just the official one. That had nothing to do with...
with the unofficial stuff, the side stuff.
Yeah, well, the gods and kings.
Oh, God.
No, I don't think you're... I don't think life has been changed.
I'm a lightweight comparison, you know, but still.
I only have 460 hours played, but then I've played some offline, so...
Yeah, I've got 1,250 in Civ 5. Civ has definitely changed my life. If you're wondering, Dan, how is that possible?
Look, you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
Welcome to this podcast.
Mackie too. But this helped me do. Well, let's see. I took over a Civilization fan site here that I looked after for almost 11 years. It got me to the point where I was the director for not one, but two gaming networks. I was able to write for a strategy magazine out of the United Kingdom for a year and a half. I was briefly on the writing staff for GameSpy. And there's this podcast, and then there was this convention I went to 6 years ago about Civ, and I got a chance to, you know, tour the Firaxis offices not once but twice. So this game has definitely had an impact on my life. You know, from the context of this thread, it changed LPMC723's life for the better. I think it hasn't improved my life for the better, but, you know, history will be the true judge of that, I suppose.
Yeah, I could say it's similar. I mean, if it wasn't for Civ 5, I probably would be streaming at some point. But I did start my YouTube and streaming based off Civ 5.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Great Admiral. Very possible to get it tossed in a ice surrounded lake. So you get it in the ocean, but you got ice tiles all around it. Good job.
Gotta ram through that with those icebreaker ships and you're good to go.
Yeah. This is why we need global warming back. Melt the ice. Increase the sea levels.
Wow. Now we need to add something so we can get rid of the ice. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be a better idea to bring back forts acting as canals? I'm just saying.
Let's burn the world just because I want to get through this ice with my great ice.
I want my great admiral. I'm going to spend the next 400 years burning coal.
Oh my gosh. I can just imagine someone listening to this and they're like, man, they're getting on someone, you know, about the one world thread rumors, saying what they'd like in the game, and then they start talking about landlocked states like, this is, we should get global warming back. What the heck are these priorities?
I know. It's bad priorities.
Let's not deliberately bring back bad things from previous games. It's okay. We don't need that. It's good.
We're good.
Yeah.
Maybe bad, but some of them are fun. It's a fun bad, and then there's an annoying bad.
Okay, Chris, if you want them, then just go back and play those Civ games then.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I can't go back to Squares after playing Hexes.
No. You can't or you won't.
Yeah. Dan, there's a point.
Yeah.
I won't.
I think all of our mottos is you don't ask for permission, you ask for forgiveness.
No, that's just yours. I have a nicer one.
No, you.
Yeah. Well.
Save us, Chris. Save us.
Ugh.
That's a tall order, I know, for a first-time guest.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we're past saving it anyway.
Already,
you can do it!
You got me in a laughing fit here.
That's the best kind of fit.
Okay, this is the podcast episode 165. Me, Christine, Matt,
this has been what? Can you try it? I don't think I can hear you over the giggling.
This has been the Polycast episode number 165 with myself, Christy, Mackie.
Right,
do people say goodbye
again?
In this? Yes, you do. Madigan.
Giggle.
Thank you.
If you're so excited you have to lie down, but are so excited that you can't stay lying down and have to get up again, chances are you're thinking of Polycast.
Okay, you just stopped me laughing completely with that. And Philip, who I have no idea how to address.
Me and team, I am not a lightweight.
Okay. Can I go back to laughing now?
Sure, why not?
And don't forget to visit thepolycast.net.
Yes. Record date January 26, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.